Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Doug Thompson, and my co-host is Deborah Maltman. And I'm just going to ask for a sound check here. Alrighty, we're doing fine then. Good. Okay, so here we are again on Sunday afternoon to study the original dictation of A Course in Miracles. And I want to start today's program, as I've done the last few weeks, by reminding everybody that Jesus has told us, wherever two or more are gathered together in my name, there also shall I be. Jesus corrected that in the Course. You corrected the next one. Inasmuch as you do it unto the least of these my children, you do it unto me. From Matthew, where it's actually brethren, not children. And in the Course, Jesus says, it really ends with, you do it unto yourself and me, which would correct that to, inasmuch as you do it unto the least of these my brethren, you do it unto yourself and me. So we are together here with Jesus, doing unto each other this shared learning of this remarkable material. So what we're doing here is for both our own learning and that of everyone. And I want to express my deep gratitude for the many contributions that many people have made over the months. The resulting work here is far more accurate, and certainly my own understanding is far better for that. For those who are here for the first time, I'm going to provide a bit of background on what we're doing, and those who are already familiar with this part can take a 5-minute break. As most of you know, the Course exists in a number of versions as a result of extensive editing and abridgment over the years. While anyone looking at the earliest raw handwritten form will recognize that it certainly needed some editing, some of the editing ended up blurring and obscuring points which were originally much clearer. One reason for studying this material is that it gives us a clearer picture not only of what Jesus originally said, but in his sidebar explanations to Helen and Bill, what he really meant. And I'm hesitating here a little bit because my computer is flashing messages at me. Something is going crazy here. I presume you can still hear me. I don't like it when it does that when I'm trying to talk. Okay, what Helen and Bill really meant. Some of us have found that added clarity of understanding to be useful. The earliest written record of the Course is found in two collections of Helen's manuscripts, her original shorthand notes and her later edited transcript known as the Urtext. Hardly a week passes that someone doesn't ask me about other versions of the Course which are also advertised or labeled as in some way original. There are actually 6 different versions of the text of the Course of which I'm aware, and 5 for which I've been able to obtain copies. Most of these have been published, and in most cases the publisher claims each is in some way original. This can cause some confusion. So what we're working with today is original in the sense of being what was written down first, the original written form by Helen Schuckman before any editing began. Now, what I've done over the past few months has been to go through the notes, identifying material which did not make it into the Urtext, and combining these two earliest and most original versions. That results in a document that's not any one of the 5 versions that Helen created, but rather a combination of the 2 earliest ones. It includes essentially all of the materials she wrote down initially, for which we have any documentary evidence. This material does have some rough spots. Some segments were written down only in point form. Some sentences were never completed. In that sense, it certainly does need some editing in places, in that it's not a finished product. The notes also include some material specifically labeled as a private point and not part of the Course. It also includes Helen's own diary entries, her commentary on what's going on, dream diaries, etc. Material that's clearly not part of the course, but was part of the days in her experience when she was taking dictation. It also includes conversations between Helen and Jesus about topics of concern to Helen at the time, and sometimes about the dictation itself. Jesus will say something, she'll ask about it, she'll challenge it in some cases, and what follows is a dialogue between the two and or an explanation by Jesus of the questions that Helen is raising. So while this isn't part of the course proper, these outtakes, if you will, provide considerable insight into Helen's experience and often involve explanations of the more formal teaching. Many of these draw from examples in Helen's or Bill's own life, and as such expand our understanding both of the course proper and the scribing experience, which resulted in what we know of today as A Course in Miracles. So what we're doing today will be a reading, some commentary and discussion of this material. Last week we got as far as T1B 32 37B. T1B 37B. I'm a little T1B 37B. Okay. I think. No. I rock. Deborah knows. Thirty-seven AB. Right. 37AB. The story about the artist who kept devoting himself to inventing better and better pencil sharpeners. Okay, I'm going to post the link to the material we're going to be reading from for those who want to follow along. There, I did it without dropping the mic, too. That should work directly for those on the radio who can't see that link. If you go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74, screen will open. Go to the top left corner, click on original dictation, and that will take you right to the same file that is linked to what I just posted there. So the basic format we're using is reading and commentary plus discussion. Anybody who feels they have something to contribute or wants to ask a question, raise your hand, or you can type a question on the board if you don't have a mic. And Deborah will be keeping an eye on the board and the hands, because I'm probably going to be looking at three other screens mostly. So Deborah's like the chairperson here. When she acknowledges your hand and drops the mic, then you can take it. And if when you have the mic, either Deborah or I raise our hands, please try to conclude your remarks and drop the mic. Towards the end of the 2 hours, I will be asking for questions. And make an attempt at summarizing some of the key points we've covered in this session. And that's about the size of it for my opening statement. And I'm going to hand the mic to Deborah at this point to make her introductions. Here you go, Deb.
Okay, this is me, Shri and Shri D, because I go by both those names. Do you know how many Deborahs there are in here? I mean, there's a lot, but that's not the reason I'm changing my name. It's just handy for now. So am I being heard? I'll do my mic check. Yes, thank you. Okay. So it's pull together time. I'm always so excited. My excitement levels are very manageable now. There's no fear level. No fear. It's just this level of excitement on low level to let me know that I'm excited. So let's pull ourselves all together into the room here together, and let all distractions fall to the side. We'll come back to them later. I think our distractions by now know that we will come back to them and address them later. I'm having a grand time, Lisa. Thanks. And to say, each of us say, if you choose to, I like to say this whenever I can through the day, whenever I remember to, although we're only instructed to say it in the morning. Help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today. And I love to say, Lord, heal me. I said that a lot yesterday. So, just taking that little breather and then an amen, because we're all joined. We're all joined together to deepen our understanding and experience of what Jesus is telling us through A Course in Miracles, and helping ourselves and each other to be the miracle workers that we have entered into becoming. And the teachers of God, we've taken that devotional commitment to become. Amen on that. And before I begin reading, is there any questions? If you tell, yeah, that's to add that to that. I'm going to right now, Doug. Help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today. If you tell me what to do, I will to do only that. That's the add-on. And that's what I should be adding on every week. I noticed that, you know, in the reading, when I was reading things over, I got to that part and thought, ah, yeah, add that in. Great reminder. Will tell me, and just writing this down. In the meantime, anybody with any questions before I commence? We did finish off last week with 37AB. We're rereading it this week because it ties in again with where we're reading, where we're beginning, would have been beginning. No hands up, no questions on the board, so here we go. Let's see, 37AB. Remember the story about the artist who kept devoting himself to inventing better and better ways of sharpening pencils. He never created anything, but he had the sharpest pencils in town. The language here is intentional. Sex is often utilized on behalf of very similar errors: hostility, triumph, vengeance, self-debasement, and all sorts of expressions of the lack of love are often very clearly seen in the accompanying fantasies. But it is profound. It is a profound error to imagine that because these fantasies are so frequent, in parentheses, or occur so reliably, that this implies validity. Remember that while validity implies reliability, the relationship is not reversible. You can be wholly reliable and entirely wrong. While a reliable test does measure something, what use is the test unless you discover what the something is? And if validity is more important than reliability and is also necessarily implied by it, why not concentrate on validity and let reliability fall naturally into place? Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, well, I think that's really key. A reliable test does measure something, but if you don't know what it's measuring, there is no validity behind the reliability. And the validity-reliability issue has been repeatedly addressed. It would be of great significance to research scientists like Helen and Bill, who are designing experiments that can produce results which are both reliable and valid, that the results actually tell us something that we wanted to know, as opposed to simply reliably producing a certain kind of data. And he's linking that conceptual structure to the several discourses on sex and sexuality, the most notorious line of which, or the most often commented upon line of which, is the only valid use of sex is for procreation. Well, that doesn't mean the only permissible use. The concept of validity there is a scientific one and is associated with the notion of reliability, which is going to be dealt with in greater detail in the following paragraphs. And this is also related, this reliability validity thing, to level confusion of seeking spiritual goals or ends through physical means. And one of the things that Jesus is coming at in his discussion of sex is that very often people are seeking relationship, they're seeking love, they're seeking meaning in their life through the physical sex act, and that's simply not valid. You can't get there from here, in essence. It's a level confusion. It won't work. You cannot get to the eternal through the physical. That's not that's not the path to, say, love. And that is the context, as I understand it, within which this validity, reliability metaphor is being used, which would be of more relevance to a research scientist who's designing experiments than it is to most of us. But if we understand that context, I think we can catch the drift of that metaphor. And we are here still on the instructions about sex, which Jesus previously noted the miracle worker must understand. And partly because of the confusion between miracle impulses and sexual impulses, which he's going to get into in two paragraphs. So I'm going to drop the mic for you, Deborah.
T1B 37 AD. Intellect may be a displacement upward, but sex can be a displacement outward. How can man come close to others through the parts of him which are really invisible? The word invisible means cannot be seen or perceived. What cannot be perceived is hardly the right means for improving perception. Doug.
Okay, this line, along with the only valid use of sex line, is the one that I've been most often asked about. Like, what does this mean? Sex can be a displacement outward, and by displacement, I think Jesus is meaning something like a distraction, shifting our focus away from what's real and putting up a smokescreen, as the intellect may be a displacement upward. If we over-intellectualize an issue, we can end up playing with words all day long and never get at what's going on. And sex can be a displacement outward in terms of moving away from the inner meaning towards physical expression by itself, or sharpening pencils instead of drawing pictures. How can man come close to others through parts of him which are really invisible? What does that mean? The word invisible means cannot be seen or perceived. What cannot be perceived is hardly the right means for improving perception. Well, if we put this together with some of the other teaching on sex, where he draws attention to the fact that sexual fantasies tend to be associated with body parts. They're not even dealing with the body as a whole, but certain parts of the body come to have sexual significance and other parts don't. And of course, the parts that are most significant sexually are the parts which are normally invisible. Most of us aren't nudists, and most of the time our sex organs are covered up or invisible. And I think that's what he's talking about here, that mankind, humans, come close to others through parts, genitals, which are generally invisible. I think that's what he means, but I'm not absolutely sure, and I see Teddy has typed toes and earlobes are great. You take that one up with Jesus, Teddy. Here you go, Deborah.
I'm I'm really not clear on this paragraph here. But people generally remove their clothes when they have sex, so then their genitals are quite easily seen. So to me, it was speaking someplace else. And I was going to mention, Lisa, you, because when I was listening last week to what was said before, and you had brought up something, and I couldn't remember what it was. So here you go. Here's the mic.
Hi. My understanding of what this means, the intellect may be a displacement upward, but sex can be a displacement outward. In my healing, it has been both of those that I was doing constantly. In my belief that I was actually coming close or identifying with other people, what I was doing was I would intellectually have this kind of supposed bond or sexually have this supposed bond, but not really coming close. You know, that I was actually just, it was just fantasy, you know. So that's really truly what I really feel resonates with me as to what that means.
And when you were reading, when you were talking, Doug, when you mentioned fantasy, that was kind of coming through to me as well, only it wasn't, I was looking, scanning through here to see was fantasy mentioned in this area. Was it mentioned? That's why I couldn't figure out what exactly he was really saying, because we weren't on the area of fantasy either. But, I mean, it sounds good to me, Lisa. Teddy, here you go.
Tell me where it is you were reading, because I remember reading this once before, and getting something about it, about the whole invisibility thing. So tell me where I could find it again. Text B. 1B 37 AD. 1B 37. I don't think I have the same. Is there a link? Intellect may be control T 1B 37 AD. Major contribute the witness or experience. Important thing is the Bible represent me to men. Those are the words which start the sentence. Let me find it again, because what I think I got. I want to find this because I think he's saying, actually what he's saying is the opposite in a sense. Intellect may be, but I don't paste. Let me see. Oh, it keeps on. 1 second. Okay, so it's T1B. Instructions on sex, is that it? The word cannot be seen or perceived. Oh, okay. So I think, okay. Intellect may be a displacement upward, but sex can be a displacement outward. How can man come close to others through the parts of him which are really invisible, cannot be seen or perceived? What cannot be perceived is hardly right means for Okay. So what he's actually saying is that what you're relating to is actually not real, therefore it is like invisible. Like you're relating to things, you're relating to parts of a person that don't really exist. They can't be seen because they are invisible, and you can't really perceive him. Much like he says the Holy Spirit, you can't see him, but you can perceive him through what occurs. It's like if you're not able to perceive, meaning like sense that they're actually there, then if they're not actually there, then you can't actually perceive that they have effects. He's talking about like in a fantasy, you're not really relating to anything that's actually real, anything that's actually like perceptible. You're relating to like thoughts about things in your mind that don't have an existence. So what's actually going on is you're being turned on in your mind by your own thinking about something that doesn't exist. So, you know, like Dove likes to quote the thing that Regina said, which I don't like necessarily, like it's true in one way, but where he says your real thoughts are not the people, but your real thoughts are, your real relationships are with your thoughts about the people. Now, those aren't your real relationships. The relationships that you think you're having are the ones, unless your mind is healed, you're not relating to the person at all. You're relating to the thoughts in your mind that you have about this person, which represents invisible, you know, it's not really what's visible about the person at all, or can it ever be seen, because it's not part of your person, it's not part of your brother, it's a part of your idea about your brother. So you're relating to things that can't be seen because they don't have any existence, and you can't actually perceive them because there's nothing there to perceive but your own ideas about what he is that turn you on. Which is why, in a sense, when, you know, like, and I know all you got, like, everybody's had this experience at one level. You know, it's like there are times when, like, the idea of sex is more sexual and sensual than the actual action of sex, because you're building it up in your mind based on all your thoughts of what it's going to be. And then when the performance actually happens, it doesn't, in order to attend to it, it doesn't relate at all to it. So you're actually not really, like, joining with the person even at that level. Yeah, the most important sex organ is the mind. And the mind has to be open to what your brother really is in order for the joining to take place at all. So when your mind is closed because it's just on the idea of sex, then you're relating to, like, you're stimulating yourself in your own mind based on what you would like it to be. So that's what I think. Like, I think he's actually not talking about body parts as much as perceptions that you have that you use to get yourself off. And rather than just admit that, you know, you're getting yourself off, you project that onto your brother, which is why there's always this letdown after sex, because it didn't live up to your fantasies about what the hell it was supposed to do and how it was supposed to be.
Actually, Teddy, I think that's moderately brilliant, especially if we take the first sentence in the context of the following two, where it starts off by focusing on the intellect, which is a mental process. And I was always wondering, like, why did he stick that in there? But maybe the context here is precisely mental or intellectual. The intellect may be a displacement upward, but sex can be a displacement outward, both of which occur in the mind. How can a man come close to others through the parts of him, the mind, the intellect, which are really invisible or cannot be seen or perceived? What cannot be perceived is hardly the right means for improving perception. That actually makes more sense than any other interpretation I've seen. I thank you for that. All right. Deborah.
Okay, carrying on here at T1B37AE. Thanks a lot, Teddy, by the way. The confusion of miracle impulse with sexual impulse is a major source of perceptual distortion, because it induces, rather than straightening out, the basic level confusion which underlies all those who seek happiness with the instruments of the world. That's a long sentence, which I'm going to read again. The confusion of miracle impulse with sexual impulse is a major source of perceptual distortion, because it induces, rather than straightening out, the basic level confusion which underlies all those who seek happiness with the instruments of the world. A desert is a desert is a desert. You can do anything you want in it, but you cannot change it from what it is. It still lacks water, which is why it is a desert. Parentheses. Bring up that dream about the bluebird. While Helen Schuckman was looking for this dream, she came across another. The message was to bring both as an example, excellent example, of how extremely good Helen Schuckman had become over the intervening 25 years at sharpening pencils. Note that the essential content hasn't changed. It's just better written. Close parentheses. The thing to do with a desert is to leave. Doug.
Alrighty. Okay, the context of the previous discussion and all of the previous discussions and the following discussions on sex is the confusion of miracle impulses with sexual impulses. We dealt a lot with that last week. And Jesus' explanation to Helen and Bill as to how that confusion can be corrected. This essentially continues that explanation. And we probably should do a review of the pair together to make that point clearer. But when we get into level confusion, and it's all, that's what it's about, it's a level confusion. The confusion of the miracle level with the sexual level, or the spiritual with the physical. And again, he stresses that this confusion underlies all those who seek happiness with the instruments of the world. Again, that theme of the quest for spiritual goals, such as love, for instance, or an authentic relationship with someone, or happiness, as in this sentence, cannot be achieved with the instruments of the world, or merely physical instruments. We like to think they can. The world, as ego sees it, tells us that it's the stuff that causes happiness, but in fact, we can't. The spiritual goal can only be achieved through spiritual means, not physical. Now, the physical tools can be servants of the spirit, but in and of themselves, the servants can't reach the goal. And then the metaphor of the desert. You can't change the desert from what it is. You can't change the physical from what it is. The desert lacks water. The physical lacks the spirit, which makes it a desert. And so this preoccupation with the physical, or the sexual impulse, the sexual and the physical are being equated here, is compared to the desert, and the thing to do with the desert is leave. Leave aside the attempt to achieve spiritual goals with physical instruments, because it simply doesn't work. And now we get into what's really a diary entry from Helen about her friends Dave and Esther, who we've heard much about in previous weeks, earlier in this chapter. And this basically tells us what happened with Dave and Helen's reactions to it. In some sense, she's just writing a diary. In some sense, she's talking to Jesus. And the following comments from Jesus actually refer back to some of the points she's raising in this segment. And I think I'm just going to let Deborah read the whole part that's bold italic there, from T1B37AE N1 through to N7. There's seven paragraphs of her diary here. Here you go, Deborah.
Okay, first of all, Lisa, you have your hand up, so here's the mic.
Thanks, Deb. I just wanted to say that for me, the intellect and the sex is so similar, it's practically identical. in that both of them are neutral. They cannot bring happiness any more than they can bring despair. Thinking that it can is another way that we confuse the sexual impulse with the miracle impulse. Because we think that sex brings us closer, we think that that's love. We think that brings happiness. While it can be used by the Holy Spirit as an expression of love using the body as a communication device, it is still not and never could be the source of the joy, the love, and the miracle. And a relationship, quote-unquote, based on sex or on intellect is not a holy relationship because it is based on something that is nothing. And so people trying to come together or believing that they are coming together through these parts of themselves, which are really, they're really nothing. They're really invisible. They're really nothing. The intellect, you know, connecting from a part of them that's not even real, and the sex, again, connecting through a part of them that's not even real and calling that love when it's still just a special relationship. Just wanted to share that before you moved on. Thank you.
Yeah, what would be used from that would be both used as a tool by Holy Spirit to bring the people together in their right minds, would be the final of it. Thanks, Lisa. So I'm going on to T1B37AE-N1. So we're into notes material that has not been out before. Double parentheses. Esther called to say that Dave Diamond died. Maybe that was his way of leaving the desert. Dave loved Esther and Arnie Gold and the children he taught. I don't know about his own children, but I do know, in parentheses, from Esther, that he doesn't get along with Terry. A while back, she told me that Dave would not let her into the room and kept telling her to go out. And she just hung around all day in the hallway or the lounge nearby. I went into the room, (in square brackets) under instructions, and spoke to Dave, who was very groggy. Every time he opened his eyes, I said, "We all love you, so don't be afraid." Not aloud, I prayed that he would be able to love everybody in return. In square brackets, this too was under instruction. Having been told, in square brackets, I think on great authority, that his only real danger came from lacks in this connection. There's a stray parentheses there, close parentheses, so I'm just noting it. I didn't visit him this Friday, but I am sure this was right because I was very careful to ask. I was going over, too, after the lecture and was told not to. Perhaps there was no need to know involved. I am upset about it, and I am leaving my notes for a while. I think I'd rather pay just more. Esther said Terry was talking about giving away the baby. I jumped to the conclusion that I was supposed to take her, but that may easily be an indiscriminate miracle impulse. I think I'd better just stop now. Double close parentheses. I prayed for Dave and said that whatever miracles I could do for him, even now, or any of his family, I would will to do. I also asked Jesus to help Dave with the course. Then I was told to go in and visit with Jonathan and pray for him, particularly if he was asleep, which he was. It was the only time so far I prayed intensively for him. When this happens, I am strongly aware that I am not praying alone. We told Jonathan that he should forget about the Alexandrian Library and all the rest, because it didn't matter. He showed a lot of love this time and should claim his forgiveness. He does not need to hurt himself and must stop these symptoms of disequilibrium and establish his freedom. He woke up and said he was feeling better but hungry. I was going to wash my hair after fixing his dinner, but I was told to visit his mother. I'm not too enthusiastic about this, but am going now. It occurred to me while waiting for the elevator that I was glad I was going, because it was a way of atoning to Jonathan for my being so nasty to him. Double open parentheses, he is always happy to have me visit his mother. Double close parentheses, and in a way of atoning for Dave, too. Oops. Don't know if you wanted to pick up the mic. You do. Here you go, Doug.
Yeah, I was just kind of getting lost in your reading there and forgetting to click. This is such a touching little snapshot of a day in Helen's life where she'd been having a quarrel with her husband, Louis, who she calls Jonathan. And here's the news that her dear friend Dave had died, which wasn't really a surprise. She knew he was terminally ill and had been visiting him frequently in the hospital and praying for him. Her concerns about Dave's daughter and granddaughter, and the way she takes her concerns to Jesus very, very, very consistently. In the first paragraph, N1, I went into the room under instructions and spoke to Dave. And I prayed that he would be able to love everybody in return. And he apparently had some quarrel with his daughter and was not able to return her love. And she says, this too was under instruction. Having been told, in brackets, I think on great authority. So this too was her at least having the sense that she was being directed. And then that line in N3, I think I'd rather pay just more, is what it actually is written in her handwriting, the best I can make out. But I think I think the pay was meant to be pray. And I'm not entirely sure what that means. It's a legibility problem in the shorthand notebooks themselves. And then, again, under instructions, she was told to pray for Jonathan, who was asleep. And she felt she wasn't alone, that she was with Jesus in her prayer. And apparently Jonathan was having some issue about the Alexandrian Library. And he was something of an antiquarian, Louis, Jonathan, operated a used bookstore. And perhaps there's some connection there with his concern with ancient books. The Alexandrian Library, for those who don't know, was destroyed in 50 AD by none other than Julius Caesar, and had been for 400 years the largest repository of books in the world. And Alexandria had become a massively significant center of scholarship and learning, and a huge amount of the history of the world before AD 50 went up in smoke at that point. And it's this loss, for anyone who's interested in history, is of incalculable significance. And then, after she's praying for Jonathan, she feels moved. She's instructed again to go visit Louis's mother, which is something that he was always very happy when she did. And so she's feeling like there's some kind of atoning or reconciliation happening. And she specifically states atoning to Jonathan, or Louis, for having been so nasty to him. Just an amazingly touching glimpse into Helen, the human being, dealing with her own personal situations, relationships, friends, husband, with Jesus as she's taking down the course. I find that just such a touching little aside, but clearly it's not part of the course. But I'm very happy to have that particular material available. Okay, so that brings us to T1B 38. And she's picking up the next day here, at least the next day. It could be a greater gap in time. It's not dated. And I think that some of what Jesus is talking about here is directly responding to her life situation and the relationship issues she's dealing with him. So here you go, Deborah.
It's really awesome about Helen with the way that she actually shows that she is, as a course, a student, even though she resists doing the course. I don't know that she ever did the course, and she claims she left the world so she could get her ego out of the way so the course could do its work here in the world. And then she shows that throughout in different things where she's picked up on will to do and she's put it into place, and she's praying and then mentioning how she's noticing that she's not alone in that praying, and then mentions forgiveness when she's talking about Jonathan, and should claim his forgiveness and love. So she's like theming this or streaming this, threading it, in effect, all the way through what she writes in areas, and yet she resisted it so strongly. I really am impressed with her. So T1B 38. Miracles arise from a miraculous state of mind. By being one, this state of mind goes out to anyone, even without the awareness of the miracle worker himself. The impersonal nature of miracles is because atonement itself is one, uniting all creations with their creator. The miracle is an expression of an inner awareness of Christ and acceptance of his atonement. Oh, okay, I'm going to finish this paragraph, Doug. The mind is then in a state of grace and naturally becomes gracious, both to the host within and the stranger without. By bringing in the stranger, he becomes your brother. Here's the mic.
Yeah, I see these two paragraphs as directly addressing the kinds of concerns and experiences Helen was talking about in her diary entry there. And as you were reading, I had a chance to look at the board, and I see a question there from Lynn, I believe it is. Do you think the term atoning that she uses has anything to do with the atonement? I think it does, and I think these two paragraphs specifically stitch it together, that Jesus has defined atonement a few pages earlier as undoing illusions and barriers and blocks that we have created. So she is atoning to Jonathan or Louis by, first of all, praying for him with Jesus, empathizing with his concern about the Alexandrian library, and trying to lift whatever this concern was, we don't know, from his shoulders. And in this process, followed by her following guidance to visit his mother, she's atoning or undoing the nastiness that she had expressed to him earlier. And I don't know exactly how to tie that in with, and in a way of atoning for Dave too, I'm not sure what undoing or atoning for Dave, I'm not sure what that precisely means. But then Jesus goes on in those next two paragraphs to emphasize that miracles arise from a miraculous state of mind. And in that state of mind, or that state of mind, goes out to anyone, even without the awareness of the miracle worker himself. And this again stresses the impersonal nature of miracles, because the atonement itself is one, uniting all creations with their creators. So it's not personal. It's not just for you or just for me. It's for all creation, because it is one. It is part of the whole of which we are all a part. So any advancement in oneness, we might say, from a miraculous state of mind that pours love into the ocean benefits the entire ocean, not just any one element of that ocean in particular. Stressed again in 39A that the inner awareness of Christ and the acceptance of his atonement, his undoing, releasing, freeing, saving, that this puts the mind in a state of grace and naturally becomes gracious both to the host within, which is to say one's true self, and the stranger, the person you don't know, the person you may never know, the person you may never have known without. But in that graciousness, you are bringing in the stranger, you are bringing in the one, and the sense of brotherhood with all emerges, which is precisely, I think, what Helen was experiencing following the news of Dave's death that she talked about in the previous diary entry. And I think here Jesus is essentially reflecting and distilling Helen's experience in answering or responding to her expressions of genuine love, miracle-mindedness, and atonement. And I see Carmen writing, sounds so Roman Catholic, doesn't it? I don't know. Does that sound Roman Catholic? There's certainly some Christian elements to it. Anyways, Deborah, here you go.
Lisa, take the mic.
What I got from this when she said atoning is that initially, before one fully gets that it's their own thinking that causes their own guilt and their own judgment, and they're still thinking that they have guilt for doing something or having a judgment against someone else because they have been affirming that belief in separation with another person, that from the guilt and that the atoning for actually is an action that a person takes to change the perception in him or herself from guilt and judgment to love. Without necessarily going the full gamut into forgiveness just by realizing that it is only our own attack thoughts that hurt us, there is still this physical part that the person feels they need to do. And so her atoning for in lieu of praying for someone or doing something for someone is, in a sense, making up for something that she is holding against herself and holding against this other person. And by doing so, it actually brings about the atonement because it truly returns her to joining. It has actually been a proven technique that when a person cannot see the error of their thinking, but they are so wrapped up in a judgment or a resentment against another person, to pray for them, to have everything that you need or want in your own life, to pray for them, to have everything that they need or want in their life, like just to pray for their highest good, just to pray for them, because all of that energy and focus is going into the belief in separation. So the person would pray for the other person, and that would correct the resentments or the judgments, because now where they were focused on fear, they're focused on love. And now where there was guilt and judgment, now they're focused on being the same and seeing themselves as the other and seeing the other as themselves. And so even though that is still not the full, like the forgiveness, it still brings about the atonement in the fact that the focus and the intention is still the same, to atone for what I did or what I'm holding against myself or what judgment I'm holding against someone else. Thanks.
Well, yeah, I think that that's quite relevant, Lisa. I'm not sure. I mean, sometimes it can be a sense of guilt. I did my brother wrong, so I need to atone for it. And in the common usage of atonement, it basically means pay a debt, atone for my sin, which makes the error real. But it can also be a recognition that I was nasty to him, and in doing so, I created a barrier between myself and this man I love, and I want to undo that barrier. It need not necessarily be so much a sense of guilt, though it could be, as a recognition that there's a block I have put in this relationship that's very important to me with a person who's very important to me, and I want to remove that block, undo what I've done. And therefore, I will pray for him and go visit his mother because I know he's going to appreciate that. And his happiness, his well-being, is my concern, as well as undoing the barrier I have mistakenly erected between myself and him. None of which necessarily has to take us into the land of guilt illusions or trying to make sins real. When we speak harshly to someone, when we are nasty, when we are whatever, we tend to create barriers, sometimes more in our own minds than in another. The other may not take as seriously what we did as we do ourselves. And the undoing of that barrier is an aspect of, or an example of, the atonement. The undoing of the blocks to the awareness of love's presence. And so by acting out of love, in praying for and visiting his mother and making his dinner, in these acts of love, the barrier is undone and the relationship is restored and the awareness of love's presence returns. Yeah. Okay. Deborah, here you go.
Okay, I'm going to go on with reading on T1B39B. The miracles you are told not to perform have not lost their value. They are still expressions of your own state of grace, but the action aspect of the miracle should be Christ-controlled because of his complete awareness of the whole plan. The impersonal nature of miracle-mindedness ensures your own grace, but only Christ is in a position to know where grace can be bestowed. Doug.
Okay, well, first of all, this relates, obviously, to the miracle principle about miracles should not be indiscriminate, and the whole problem of Edgar Cayce trying to fix everybody and wearing himself out. And we have an explanation here, the impersonal nature of miracle-mindedness. Again, impersonal, which means not indiscriminate. That is to say, we don't come up with what miracles need to be done. We wait for instructions. Because only Christ is in a position to know where grace can be bestowed in a way that can be genuinely beneficial. Now, the first line is interesting, the first sentence. The miracles you are told not to perform have not lost their value. This was changed in the Hugh Lynn Cayce version to the miracles you are not told to perform. And I would agree with whoever made that change that that actually makes more sense. There's a little bit of a difference between spontaneously deciding to try to perform a miracle, and which would be the indiscriminate miracle, the miracle you're not told to perform, versus having been told not to do something and going ahead and doing it anyway. But in either case, I think the rest of the paragraph is applicable. And in both the ear text and the shorthand notes, the wording is as you see it. The miracles you are told not to perform, with emphasis on not, have not lost their value. And whether that can be equated to the miracles you are not told to perform is an open question to which I don't have an answer. But that is one of the editing changes which I would say is a contestant for being a genuine correction. There's certainly a good case to be made that that altered wording makes more sense than the original. There's not a lot of those examples, but that would be one where I can certainly see an argument for the HLC wording. Okay. Deborah, here you go.
I just wanted to go over that again. The miracles you are told not to perform have not lost their value, as opposed to the miracles you are not told to perform have not lost their value. I actually like this one better myself, because the implication in it to me is that someone told not to perform and they go ahead and perform, that doesn't lose the value, that it's got the same value. It's hard on the miracle worker and may have done some distortion somehow in there. I have no idea how. Could come up with reasons, but to me it makes perfectly good sense. Actually, I like it. Doug, here's the mic.
There's another connection here in the second sentence that I just noticed. They are still expressions of your own state of grace, but the action aspect of the miracle should be Christ-controlled. This connects to what we were looking at 2 weeks ago with the listen, learn, do. Or was it last week? Anyways, recently. Listen, learn, and do. And the doing, was stressed, is the only part that's involuntary. That's not your choice. I have to choose to listen. That's an act of will. I have to choose to learn. That's an act of will. But the doing should be entirely Christ-controlled. Having listened and learned, I know that do only what I'm told to do and nothing else, which connects to the miracle worker's prayer. If you will tell me what to do, I will to do only that. That those three quotes, listen, learn, do, if you will tell me what to do, I will do only that. And the action aspect of the miracle should be Christ-controlled because of his complete awareness of the whole plan. So the listening and the learning are things we must will to do. But the doing or action aspect, we must submit to Christ's control. Otherwise, we're being told here, it hasn't entirely lost its value, but its efficacy, its effectiveness, probably will be not very good because it doesn't fit, or it's likely not to fit, likely not to be terribly beneficial, misplaced, and it wears us out. Okay, Teddy's writing up a storm here. So is Lisa, and I will look at that as Deborah reads the next paragraph. Here you go, Deb.
Okay, 40A. T1B 40A. A miracle is never lost. It touches many people you may not even know, and sometimes produces undreamed of changes in forces of which you are not even aware. This is not your concern. It will always bless you. This is not your concern either, but it is the concern of the record. The record is completely unconcerned with reliability, being perfectly valid because of the way it was set up. It always measures what it was supposed to measure. Just want to make sure I read that right. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay. The record. What is the record? Best guess I have is he's referring to the Akashic record and that body of esoteric literature which suggests that, oh man, can I even define what the Akashic record is? That everything that ever has been or will be in space and time exists in some kind of information, as some form of information, which is accessible, which is how people can have clairvoyance and see into the future, or perhaps see into the past as well. And why this is a concern for the record, measuring what it's supposed to measure, is interesting, because again he's pointing out that a miracle is never lost and it may touch many people you don't even know and sometimes produces undreamed of changes in forces of which you are not even aware, but that's not your concern. It will always bless you. And that's not your concern either, because that is the concern of the record. And just why and how that is, I don't think I'm prepared to say a whole lot more. And in a direct sense, I don't believe the concept of record recurs beyond this one reference to it. But it has something to do with cause and effect and how they ultimately all work themselves out, or karma, if you will. So it will bless you. It's not your concern. It's somebody else's. It's, I think, what I want to leave it at there. All right. Deborah, here you go.
Actually, there is one. There is another place where it does mention record, but it's coming up in the paragraphs that I'm going to be reading next. So we're going to be getting into that. You have a comment about what was read, Lisa?
Well, when I read this before, and I asked about this, it was the record that the souls come into the body to improve upon, and that it was brought back to the purification process with the Holy Spirit, that the Holy Spirit takes what is not true and discards it, takes what is partially true and purifies it, and takes what is purely true and keeps it for the record. That everything that you've ever created, everything that's ever come from love, all of it is saved for you, and that the purpose is to remove all of the blocks and to have the past purified to release time, but that souls come into the body to improve the record. That's really what that's about. So, thank you.
That's what I was saying, that we were just coming into. So we're going to start reading on T1B 40B, Instructions on Sex. I want to finish the instructions about sex because this is an area the miracle worker must understand. Inappropriate sex drives, parentheses, or misdirected miracle impulses, in close parentheses, result in guilt if expressed and depression if denied. We said before that all real pleasure comes from doing God's will. Whenever it is not done, an experience of lack results. This is because not doing the will of God is a lack of self. And that's self in capital letters. I guess that's been corrected. Sex was intended as an instrument for physical creation to enable souls to embark on new chapters in their experience and thus improve their record. The pencil was not an end in itself. In parentheses, see earlier section. It was an aid to the artist in his own creative endeavors. as he made new homes for souls and guided them through the period of their own developmental readiness, he learned the role of the Father himself. The whole process was set up as a learning experience in gaining grace. The pleasure which is derived from sex as such is reliable only because it stems from an error which men shared. Awareness of the error produces guilt. Denial of the error results in projection. Correction of the error brings release. The only valid use of sex is procreation. It is not truly pleasurable in itself. Lead us not into temptation means do not let us deceive ourselves into believing that we can relate in peace to God or our brothers with anything external. Doug.
Okay, well, as we were discussing earlier, here we have the hot wire line that so many people react to. And in this larger context in which validity and reliability have been discussed in their scientific sense as elements of experimental methodology, we can see what he means by valid. That the use of sex for pleasure is invalid because sex can't bring real pleasure. And the only reason it seems to is because of an error that men shared. And the awareness of error produces guilt, denial of the error results in projection, correction of the error brings release, and correction is required. This also relates to the confusion between miracle and sexual impulses. So the only valid use of sex is procreation, which I would interpret as meaning the use of sex for pleasure is not valid because it doesn't really bring pleasure. It brings pseudo-pleasure only, and in the end is going to generate guilt or denial and projection. So, lead us not into temptation, a line from the Lord's Prayer, means do not let us deceive ourselves into believing that we can relate in peace to God or our brothers with anything external. Or anything external. Anything is emphasized there. So again, we have this theme for the third time today, that which is an aspect of level confusion, that love and joy and happiness do not come, are not caused by physical, external, material things. Those things can be used as servants for the goal, but they cannot themselves bring about the goal. They're not the cause. The cause is at the level of mind and spirit, not at the level of body and physical. And if we think that the physical act of sex is going to be pleasurable, we not only have deceived ourselves, but we are going to end up feeling guilty or in denial and projecting this, and the miracle worker must correct this error of thinking that anything external can bring release, or that we can relate in peace to God or our brothers with anything external. This is the central theme that is being stressed here, and within that context, the only valid use of sex is procreation makes perfect sense. It's not a condemnation of sexuality, or as some would read it, an argument against the use of contraceptives, which would prevent procreation in a sex act. It's rather sort of the other way around, as I hope I've managed to explain here. Okay, I'm going to give you the mic back, Deborah. I think I've said everything I want to say on that. You might have some comments on that one.
Ah, you remembered. Yeah, I do. This part was really, really so perfect for me because of an experience I had. It gave me answers to that experience. And I did talk about this in one of Teddy's recent sessions. I just want to do a mic check here to make sure that it's actually working because I stumbled getting it on. Okay, thanks, Carmen. I had souls knocking at my door to be born through me. So in the span of 7.5 years, I had 6 pregnancies and 4 live, healthy baby boys. The third full-term pregnancy resulting in my Jesse. At the time of conception, the time of lovemaking, this tiny wee voice entered my mind saying, "Can I come in? Can I be born?" And at that moment, my emotional part, I was really stressed out. I was really overspent and felt I could not receive a baby at this time. So emotionally, I heard myself scream out inside, "No!" A really loud scream. And what followed that was my spiritual side, or my soul, I guess, because I was in complete peace with that. And it said a very yes to Jesse. And Jesse was conceived, and I knew immediately that Jesse was conceived. So I told my partner we're pregnant following that. And what I thought about earlier today when I was thinking about that situation, that I used to think in terms of, all these little babies, all these little soul babies are knocking at our doors at the moment of conception, and we're having this little dialogue, but we just aren't aware of it. But I don't think so. I think in terms, that was Jesse's way, and Jesse as a little boy, if there was 6 plates of food on the table and there were 6 people present to eat the food, and 5 of the people had their plates, he would walk up to the last plate and he would say, "Is this mine?" He was always checking on something. So I think it was just Jesse's process and his need to check with me as a soul. Is it okay for me to come through you and be born? And I think that I won't pretend to know what anything other than that would be, other than suggesting that we have made commitments previous to this. So Doug, here's the mic.
Well, yeah, that is Jesse all over. I mean, that is Jesse's personality. Quite credible in that sense. In the context of the record, in the Akashic record, which just preceded this, this reminds me of something I read many years ago from Rudolf Steiner, the founder of Anthroposophy, which most people will know of mostly through the Waldorf school movement, which he created. He claimed to be able to read the Akashic record and offered some pretty persuasive evidence that he really could see into the future. And in his discussion of reincarnation and the Akashic record, he said that before we are born at the soul level or the higher self, and when self is capitalized here in the Course, that's what it's referring to. It's almost equivalent to soul. At the soul level, or in our higher selves, in our true selves, before we incarnate, we work out with our spiritual guides a plan for where we're going to be born, who's going to be our parents, and the general circumstances of our existence. This doesn't mean that we work out all the details of that lifetime, because in the classroom, in the teaching device that is the earth and space and time, we sometimes get the lessons quick and sometimes we have to repeat the lessons many times before we get them. But we put ourselves into a situation that in consultation with our spiritual guides, that is optimized for our particular learning requirements. What do I need to learn? Where can I best learn that? And then with whom can I best learn that? And with other souls, we make these arrangements, according to Steiner, as to, okay, in this lifetime, I'm going to be your dad. In the last lifetime, I was your daughter, perhaps. And we have some stuff in the record, some karmic unhealed issues to work out, and that relationship of father-son is going to give us, in that relationship, those two souls, an ideal opportunity to do that. Plus, it's the perfect place for that soul to be born to deal with other particular issues that he's got to deal with. So in that sense, I think that when a baby is born into the world, it is an expression of an agreement between two souls made in another dimension. And it's not an accident of birth, who my parents are, or what place I'm born. It's a very carefully worked out decision, and it's exactly the right place and exactly the right time for that particular soul. And what comes to happen in that person's life is what that person chose in terms of those things that are a product of his circumstances of time and place of birth. And then what he does with those circumstances is his ongoing learning, which is what he came here to do, to improve his record. Okay, so that's not from the course, that's from Rudolf Steiner, but I think that if you line up what Jesus is saying here in these sections and what Steiner has said, I see a pretty good match and the possibility of perhaps some clarification. So, on that note, Deborah.
Okay, so I guess I will carry on reading that. T1B40H. That's where, no. I think I start at T1B40G. Right, thanks. The sin of Onan was called a sin because it involved a related type of self-delusion, namely, that pleasure without relating can exist. Doug.
Okay, well, this is the fourth time in today's reading that this same theme, which pertains directly to level confusion, has been repeated. That pleasure without relating, this directly relates to the only valid use of sex is procreation. The sin of Onan comes from, and I have footnoted it fortunately, Genesis 38, 8 to 11. And in the footnote, the whole passage is there. And basically, it has to do with coitus interruptus. Onan decided he was basically having sex with a prostitute, and he thought he was having sex with a prostitute, and then he realized it was his brother's wife or something, and he didn't want to get her pregnant, so he withdrew before he had an ejaculation, and a couple of days later he was killed. And the people of the time saw that as God punishing Onan for not doing what, and I believe it was the case, and I'm not going to take the time to check, but if memory serves me right, it was the case that Jewish law of the time specified that if a man died, his brother had a responsibility to take care of his children and give his wife more children. So, if my brother dies, I have to take his wife into my home and make her pregnant. That was the law at the time. And Onan was breaking the law. He was saying, no, I don't want to do that. And so his brother's wife dressed up as a prostitute to trick him into having sex with her because she wanted a baby, and Onan figured out the ruse and wouldn't play ball, and then he died, and this was seen as God's punishment for his law-breaking. So, the related type of self-delusion, namely that pleasure without relating can exist, was going on with Onan because he thought he was hiring a prostitute, i.e. pleasure without relating. And that was Onan's mistake in Jesus' description of it here. Okay. Carmen writes, children were their idea of immortality in the favor of God. I just happened to glance at the board there. Unfortunately, folks, I'm not reading most of what's getting typed because I'm focusing on the text here. But I saw that one partly because it's bright pink. Yes, children were their idea of immortality in the favor of God. And we only have to remember Abraham and Sarah and their intense concern for having descendants. Absolutely intense concern. Abraham and Sarah were praying and praying and praying and praying for a baby, and they didn't have any kids until they were very much on in years, yet they kept believing that God was telling them that not only would they have kids, but their kids would go on to be the founders of a great nation. And they believed that. And historically, it came to pass. There's also, in terms of the socioeconomic structure of the time, there's a reason for that Jewish, that Hebrew law about taking in your brother's wife. Because where in a culture, in a society of a pastoral culture where the primary economic activity was raising goats and sheep, and it was an extremely patriarchal society, a woman without a father or a husband or a brother was essentially a non-person. There was no job for her to take other than the job of prostitute. There was no way for her to support her family. All economic activity except for prostitution was dominated by men. So a woman who wasn't attached to a man in some way or another as a dependent would starve to death if she didn't go into prostitution. And so that law was basically a bit of a social welfare regulation, and it goes along with honor your father and your mother, that men were directed to support their parents as they got older and were unable to support themselves. And brothers were told to support their brothers' wives and kids, their sisters-in-law, and nieces and nephews, if their brother couldn't for whatever reason. So this was a kind of social welfare legislation. And similarly for adults, if you didn't have kids, kids were your old age pension. Kids were your retirement fund. Your kids were going to be the ones who looked after you when you got too old and sick to tend the goats yourself anymore. So there's some strong economic reasons for the desire to procreate, to have kids. And for women, the need was even stronger because being a mother gave a woman a socially productive role. It was a job for her, which justified her keep. And a childless woman was, in that kind of an economic situation, essentially just a burden on the family, an extra mouth to feed who wasn't contributing to the economic well-being of the family unit by making babies. So a woman's status would go way up at the point of successfully bearing a child. So all these factors are tied in there. And yeah, as Carmen writes, children as workers on the farm were seen as wealth. A man or a family could of goat herders could manage a much larger herd if they had a bunch of kids to help them look after the herd than they could entirely on their own. And then there was also that whole sense of descendants and immortality coming to one through one's offspring. So all these cultural ideas, which are pretty much alien in the modern West, were very strong at the time of Onan. So that's a whole lot about Onan in one sentence in the course. And then we move back into the sex object issue on 40H. So here you go, Deborah.
Okay, and I'm just pasting the link here for anybody that hasn't had it and wants it. For T1B40H, to repeat an earlier instruction, the concept of either the self or another as a sex object epitomizes this strange reversal. As Bill put it, and very correctly too, it is objectionable, but only because it is invalid. Upside-down logic produces this kind of thinking. Child of God, you were created to create the good, the beautiful, and the holy. Do not lose sight of this. You were right in telling Bill to invite me to enter anywhere temptation arises. I will change the situation from one of inappropriate sexual attraction to one of impersonal miracle working. The concept of changing the channel from libidinal expression is Freud's greatest contribution, except that he did not understand what channel really means. Doug.
Okay, there, I got it. I'm going to point out the use of the word invalid in 40H. To repeat an earlier instruction, the concept of either self or another as a sex object epitomizes the strange reversal, that being that pleasure can be obtained without relating. And Bill put it very correctly that it's objectionable, but only because it's invalid. And I want to string that back to the previous quote about the only valid use of sex is procreation. Again, we're being told that the use of sex as to objectify someone or obtain pleasure from their body is invalid, and that this is upside down logic. And then in 40I, Freud returns, and the Freudian idea of sublimation and changing the channel for libidinal or sexual expression to... Now, Freud suggested in his idea of sublimation is that sexual energy or libido can be converted into artistic or academic or socially constructive behavior. He saw the libido as basically life energy. And it can go into physical procreation, or it can go into, say, writing a symphony. And here Jesus is patting him on the back and saying, yeah, you got it. Except that Freud didn't understand what the channels really were, or what channel really means. And that is going to get explained here. Deborah.
T1B40J, the love of God, for a little while, must still be expressed through one body to another. That is because the real vision is still so dim. Everyone can use his body best by enlarging man's perception so he can see the real vision. This vision is invisible to the physical eye. The ultimate purpose of the body is to render itself unnecessary. Learning to do this is the only real reason for its creation. Doug.
Wow. Yeah. This stuff is so potent. So, the love of God must still, for a little while, must still be expressed through one body to another. And that's because our real vision is so dim. Everyone can best use his body best by enlarging human perception so he can see the real vision. Now here we're talking about enlarging spiritual perception, the real world that can be perceived. Now this vision is invisible to the physical eye. And I think this relates earlier to what Teddy was talking about in explaining in relation to relating to people with invisible things. And I think this actually verifies Teddy's interpretation. These two segments are linked. And then we come into this amazing statement. The ultimate purpose of the body is to render itself unnecessary. Now, this is clearly not the ego's purpose for the body. Learning to do this is the only real reason for its creation. And here we're being told that the body was A, created, and B, has a real reason, and it's not the ego's reason. And the ego, therefore, is not the creator of the body, which is elsewhere described as a teaching device for the mind. And the ego is an idea we made up that misperceives the divine purpose of the divine creation of the body. So the ego has an idea of the body which is illusory and nonsensical, but God has another idea, and that's what it is. And there we go.
Yeah, this is a really fantastic paragraph. I think I want to read it again, so I'm going to do that. It's really quite amazing. T1B40J, the love of God for a little while must still be expressed through one body to another. That is because the real vision is still so dim. Everyone can use his body best by enlarging man's perception so he can see the real vision. This vision is visible to the physical eye. This vision is invisible to the physical eye. The ultimate purpose of the body is to render itself unnecessary. Learning to do this is the only real reason for its creation. Bill, I got very uneasy here and thought maybe I was just writing all this in closed parentheses, which has been very time-consuming and quite tiresome at times, because I was jealous. I'm still not sure and need your help about this, but I went on anyway because it didn't seem finished. Please help me evaluate it because I don't want scribal errors to enter too much into the course, though I guess they'll be corrected when they do. What do you think about all this? I hadn't intended to write a commentary on sex. In parentheses, see above. It just occurred to me that the doubt may come from something I don't want to give up. Should I tell you about it? It's kind of embarrassing, really. But I just remembered the one more river with which this started. Doug.
Okay. These last two paragraphs are from the shorthand notes and are Helen. She's not taking dictation. She's making a note to Bill and expressing her uneasiness with the material she's just taken down. And that uneasiness, I think, may have something to do with the reason why, in the end, she omitted it all. I don't think she ever did become easy with it. And she's saying that maybe she was writing them because she was jealous, which is an interesting comment. She's unsure, and she's asking Bill for his help. But she went on anyway, she says, because it didn't seem finished. And she's saying to Bill, please help me evaluate it because I don't want scribal errors to enter too much into the course. And then she notes, though I guess they'll be corrected when they do. And to Bill. What do you think about all this? I hadn't intended to write a commentary on sex. And then she writes a very interesting hunch. It just occurred to me that the doubt may come from something I don't want to give up. Should I tell you about it? It's kind of embarrassing, really. But I just remembered the One More River with which this started. Now, the One More River comes up again and again and again, and it's not really thoroughly explained beyond, apparently, when Bill first typed it up, he made a Freudian slip, which Jesus proceeded to tease him about, and typed One More Rivet instead of One More River, because there was some kind of sexual connotation that Bill associated with river. And just what that is, I must say, I don't know. But Helen, I think the key thing here is that Helen is questioning her own motives. She's recognizing feelings of jealousy and embarrassment and something she doesn't want to give up that she feels she's being asked to give up in this material we've just been reading. She's taking it personally. She's feeling moved by it. She's feeling awkward, and she's doing something clever. She's asking for Bill's help. But it's interesting here that she's asking for Bill's help, and she's not specifically asking for Jesus' help on this one. So there's a sense in which, in contrast to the previous diary entry, where Helen was very much walking hand in hand with Jesus, here she's very much uncomfortable and reaching out to Bill. Help me, Bill. But not specifically to Jesus. All of which is really interesting in terms of her reaction to this material. And then Jesus enters the discussion again in T1B 40K. I just see Teddy writes, Helen was the mother Ken wished he had. Ken was the son Helen never had. And there was some kind of relationship between Helen and Bill that Bill once characterized as, I could not respond to Helen in the way she wanted, which suggested to me something that is sort of implied between the lines in many other places, that Helen had certain romantic feelings about Bill. And anyways, that is reading between the lines. I don't have any direct documentation on that one. Deborah.
I'm sitting on this line here where Helen is saying that she hadn't intended to write a commentary on sex. Well, I didn't think Helen intended to write any of what she wrote because she didn't know what was coming through. So that one, that line, I'm confused with why she would even make that, say that. That sort of tugs on the skeptical part of myself. I have a true skepticism within. Anyways, I'll carry on reading here at T1B 40K. Note, scribes have a particular role in the plan of atonement because they have the ability to experience revelations themselves and also to put into words enough of the experience to serve as basis for miracles. 40L, Doug.
Well, yeah, in response to your comment first, there's a lot of reason for skepticism in here, and most of it comes from these two paragraphs from the notes where Helen is communicating very clearly uneasiness, jealousy, embarrassment. I hadn't intended to write a commentary on sex, which I read as, I don't necessarily approve of what Jesus is dictating here. This isn't what I thought we were going to be talking about. I'm not comfortable with a commentary on sex, and I don't really want to scribe it. That's how I read that one. Whole lot of discomfort, which I think explains the ultimate removal of the material by her, more than it suggests that what she was taking down was invalid. And in 40K, Jesus is answering Helen. Scribes, you and Bill, have a particular role in the plan of atonement because you and Bill have the ability to experience revelations yourselves and put into words enough of the experience to serve as a basis for miracles. So he's essentially saying that what just happened was of a revelatory nature, and her putting it into words is helpful to others. And that line to me, that's one sentence, three lines, in T1B 40K, is Jesus affirming to Helen that, yeah, that was cool. You're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing. This is helpful. Don't worry about it. And now we have 12 minutes left, and the miracle worker's prayer, which we started talking about at the beginning today, and we're going to conclude today's session with this. Okay, Deborah.
Okay, that makes sense what you said, what you addressed to my skeptical part coming up there. It's like she sort of stepped into her ego self fully at that moment, and lost sight of even what she was doing and who she was taking dictation from, kind of, in my words. So I'm going to go on to T1B 40L, the miracle worker's prayer. Parentheses, the whole paragraph here is in parentheses. This refers to experiences at the visionary level, after which Helen Schuckman wrote, "If you will tell me what to do, I will to do it." She had not known that the word "to" was inserted and had merely intended to write, "I will do it." This recognition had a terrific impact on Helen Schuckman. Doug.
Okay, I just want to point out again that parentheses usually means for Helen that what follows, or what's between the parentheses, is her comment. This definitely is her comment about she had intended to write, but I will do it, but actually wrote, I will to do it, which wasn't even in her conscious mind, yet she recognizes that this had been what was dictated, and she got it right, and it had a terrific impact on her. And now Jesus responds to her. This is one of the dialogue sections in 40M. Deborah.
This is why you experienced that revelation was about, or the, shoot. This is why you experienced that revelation about I will to do very personally, but also wrote it. What you wrote can be useful to miracle workers other than yourself. We said before that prayer is the medium of miracles. The miracle prayer is what you wrote, i.e., if you will tell me what to do, I will to do it. Doug.
Again, we have a confirmation from Jesus here that what she's taking down is right, and her worries and concerns and even ego interference isn't making the material useless or irrelevant to others. And the basic editorial principle he directed to Bill, not very far distant in time from this, I think a bit later than this was written, was that material relating to specific relationships didn't belong in the course, but anything that could was of generalizable value to others did. And the way that Helen ended up interpreting that in her editing of the course was that anything that has anything to do with my personal life goes. Never mind measuring it by could this be useful to others. I think it was her intense privacy and sense of embarrassment about issues relating to sexuality that led her to just be unable, if not unwilling, to deal with that material in the editing process, so she just took it out and set it aside. And that's, it didn't just not make it into the Foundation version, the vast majority of this didn't make it into the Hugh Lynn Casey version either. The entire teaching on sexuality and most of the teaching on possession just vanishes. Whereas to the extent that it is does relate to personal specific persons, Helen and Bill, it clearly could have been generalized. They didn't have to use proper names to get the point across. And in the end, they ditched it all. Everything relating to sex, every instance of the word sex or sexuality or homosexuality disappears, except for one where they kept the sentence but changed the word sex to physical, which, in the absence of the context, completely loses the point. And the point was sex. Okay. We now have 7 minutes left, so I'm going to look for a spot to... We can probably get down to 40Q, where the second instance of listen, learn, do in the ear text arises, and that will be a good place to start next week. Deborah.
T140N, this prayer is the door that leads out of the desert forever. That's pretty far out. In parentheses, correction next day. This is not a complete statement because it does not exclude the negative. We have already told you to add and not to do what you would not have me do in connection with miracles. The distinction has also been made here between the miracle-mindedness as a state and miracle-doing as its expression. The former needs your careful protection because it is a state of miracle readiness. This is what the Bible means in the many references to hold yourself ready and other similar injunctions. Readiness here means keep your perception right side up, in parentheses, or valid, so you will always be ready, willing, and able. These are the essentials for listen, learn, and do. You must be ready to listen, willing to learn, and able to do. Doug.
Okay. I interrupted you too soon. I'm going to read the next paragraph here. Only the last is involuntary, because it is the application of miracles which must be Christ-controlled. But the other two, which are the voluntary aspects of miracle-mindedness, are up to you. And on that point, I think we're going to wind up for today, because we've only got 5 minutes left, and there's a few things I want to say. What we've heard today has been a repeated stress on a key concept, that the use of the physical to achieve the spiritual is invalid, doesn't work. And the context within which that's been explained has been largely sexual, or the use of sex, the body, for pleasure, being something that doesn't really bring about pleasure. And the confusion of miracle impulses with sexual impulses, which carries over from last week, meshes with the teaching on readiness. Readiness to listen, willingness to learn, and ability to do as one is guided. Most of what we've been dealing with here is teaching on readiness, how to get one's mind into the state where one can be ready to listen and willing to learn, which are preconditions for being able to do. Now, Maz has written a question here, which I can answer very briefly, I think. Why I chose to overrule Jesus' instructions? Well, I didn't choose to overrule Jesus' instructions. What I chose to do was not attempt to retroactively apply them 40 years after they'd been issued, once the material was already in publication. There was an argument before this material ever got out that the specific references to specific persons should be removed. The instruction was delivered in 1965, and it related to people who were alive and on Earth at the time. By the time the question landed on my desk, all of this material was already in print. And to apply it to people who were long deceased by blocking out segments of the material that anybody could read in any number of places elsewhere seemed simply nonsensical. So I didn't. I could see no reason to do so. It would simply have made my work a farce, and the credibility of it negligible. Clearly, I would be censoring the material in a way that wouldn't have served to prevent anyone from finding out what it was anyways. So that's my answer to that, Naz. Okay, gang, 2 minutes left. Thank you all so much. I have learned a lot today. I really enjoyed this session, as I almost always do. I think I always do. And my appreciation for all of you is enormous. Deborah, here's the mic for your goodbyes.
Okay, I picked up the mic and threw it again. Thanks very much, everyone, for your attendance and for the interaction and for everyone that spoke on the mic and also wrote on the board. This was fantastic. And thanks, Dove, for providing this venue here for us to be doing this. It's really wonderful that you do this. And thank you, Doug, for all your teaching through the years. And also, Carmen, you've been, through the years, I don't know that you know the amount of teaching that has been so valuable to me that has come from you. So, again, Doug, thank you. And radio people, thanks for listening in. To be continued next week, Sunday, 4 to 6. Thanks.
I also just want to remind everyone that most of these sessions have been recorded and are on the website if you miss something that you want to catch. And the URL, again, is www....
Doug, you dropped the mic.
Oh, great. I just wanted to remind everyone that these sessions are recorded, and you can find them at www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTHOMP74. Most of the sessions are recorded and archived there if you want to catch up on anything that you might have missed. Okay. Sorry for running over time. All right. Carmen, here is the microphone. God bless you.
Oh, guys, God bless you both. thank you again. Deborah, you honor me and bless me. And